or beautiful Monday. And we're going to take just something briefly out of order here and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2744. Janet.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2744 was sponsored by Representative Flores at the request of Susan and Jim McLaren, who are not able to come today. Representative Flores is here. It would allow patrons of a winery licensee to make wine if the winemaking is conducted under the direct supervision of the licensee or employees of the licensee. Otherwise, winemaking has to be done with a license unless you're making it at your home for home consumption. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So, Representative Flores, welcome. Tell us how we turn a bill into wine today.
I think there's a book on that. Mr. Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Linda Flores. I am state representative for House District 51, which includes Clackamas, Damascus, Boring, and Estacada. And as Ms. Adkins said, this bill was brought by a constituent, and they had a great idea, and they want to bring a new small business to Oregon. It is kind of one of the fun parts about being a citizen legislature when people have great ideas and that little venue that we have on our website about how an idea becomes law. Well, this is kind of the fundamentals and the basics. The McLarens want to open a small business, a franchise that is available in other states, and it's really quite simple. It is to teach people how to make their own wine. The Oregon law, however, currently does not allow do-it-yourself wine makers. It does help allow do-it-yourself beer makers. So anyone with a brew pub or brewery license can start a business to show beer lovers how to cook up their own brews under the supervision of the company's store staff. And, of course, the beer is only for personal consumption, but it cannot be consumed on premise. If you're a wine connoisseur, you can take classes, but you can't do any of the fun winemaking stuff like adding the ingredients and adjusting the fermentation processes unless it's in your own house and, once again, only for personal consumption. Now, the McLarens want to open a You Wine It, just like a You Brew It operation. They hope to run a franchise in Oregon, as I mentioned, that is in other parts of the of the United States, and it is an international organization. They provide all the materials for make-it-yourself wine in the store. There are already similar franchises in Texas, Colorado, California, and soon to be in Washington State. With Oregon's great wine industry, this kind of cottage industry seems to be a perfect fit. House Bill 2744 simply adds a couple of sentences to Oregon Revised Statute
471-403.
Mm-hmm. That one. And to give wine lovers the same privileges as beer lovers, and we would ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative. And the language is exactly like we have for brewery pub house licenses. Is there any discussion, questions of the Representative? We don't get her here often. You know, it might be an opportunity.
I would add, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that this bill did pass through the House committee as well as the House with virtually not one no vote. So it seems to have the universal buy-in.
Well,
from that side of the
I'm glad of that, although I will tell you, if my committee will tell you, there's a few bills that have languished in this committee that came through the House unanimously.
I know, we're seeing it.
So that's always not exactly a criterion here, but I think you might get over the hump on this one. Okay, let's close public hearing and open a work session. House Bill 2744.
Chair, I move House Bill 2744 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2744 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator George.
I can't believe we have to have a bill for this. That's it. That's all I want to say.
Any objections? All right, so ordered. Who would like to carry the bill?
Okay.
Senator Starr will carry the bill. Thank you very much. We're going to open up an informational hearing on the Real ID proposed rules to the Department of Homeland Security and ask Lerner Youngs to come forward. Yes, and you have the copy of the rules in that were provided to you here off the desk, but if you didn't have them from previous emailing last week, and the comments that were made, As you know, members, states had until a week ago to make their final comments on the proposed rules to the Real ID Act. And so since that deadline had passed, I asked Ms. Young to provide to the committee and then to discuss with us the comments that Oregon made on behalf of the citizens on Real ID. So with that, welcome. Lorna, thank you very much for coming today, and I'll turn it over to you to tell us about, to go over the comments that were made to the federal government.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lorna Youngs with the Department of Transportation, and I'm an administrator in the DMV. As the Chair stated, we had submitted our comments to the Department of Homeland Security last Monday, and our cover letter kind of says it all. We need more time. We need more money. But with that, what we proposed, what we did in our review and comment back to the Department of Homeland Security was not necessarily to cover all of the discussion that they had prepared in the preamble. We knew that there would be a wide range of comments on this proposed set of regulations. We also knew that there would be many expert groups commenting on some of the details. So what we focused on was what was the impact of this proposed set of regulations on Oregon DMV, on Oregon citizenry, and our ability to implement as proposed. I'm not going to go through every single one of them. I'll just hit the highlights and then be happy to answer any questions. The first one I wanted to point out is that they have a rather broad definition of what they consider covered employees, i.e. those employees for which they would expect a background check. And we're concerned that individuals who are data entry operators who are putting in just an address change would fall in their definition, and that would increase the burden on the agency. So we wanted a little bit narrower definition to get at the heart of it, and those are the individuals who could affect putting the identity and legal status information on the record. That went on to comment about Social Security documentation and ability to apply for Social Security documentation and in terms of our being able to verify. We have some concerns that the federal government is not exactly clear on eligibility. There are certain classes of individuals who are immigrant status who are ineligible for Social Security, and the same individuals within that class are also eligible for a Social Security number, students, for example. And so we were asking from the federal government, if you want us to verify who's eligible and not, why don't you set up a system that is definitive rather than to the individuals so that we can be quite clear about Social Security verification. In the section of the Act that I spoke to this a little bit on my last time before you, they've developed an exceptions process for individuals who do not have documentation of their identity, such as Katrina victims, individuals whose where the courthouse burned down and they don't have their birth certificate. Yet there is no exception process for proof of legal presence. Many of the documents are exactly the same thing. If you do not have a passport and all you have is a birth certificate, it is both proof of your identity and proof of your legal presence in the United States. And so we felt that there should be an exception process for both legal presence and your identity. There's a whole group of comments on document verification, and probably the most significant part of our concerns about document verification is that, as we've stated many times before you, there simply are not the systems in place to do that. And so it doesn't make sense to require document verification until those systems are established. And then also, there should be a reasonable time period for states to connect to those systems. It's not an overnight process to connect once a system becomes available for national use. And so we're proposing that they require only those systems that are nationally available be the ones you verify documents with, and then as other ones become available, then you're expected to connect to those. They have a range of security features that they're proposing for the card, and quite frankly, many of those security features add considerable cost and aren't necessarily going to provide the most flexible security, in the sense that they have looked for a level of security that would require at least $3 more per card, just for the card itself. It requires a certain kind of card because they're asking for laser engraving. And we, as well as other states, are looking for a little more flexibility on how you achieve security features because they're a combination of features. So we think that this is a little bit of a... The standard's a little more rigorous than need be, especially then once you break the code on this national card, then you essentially have it for the whole of the U.S., and there is a value to having a little more flexibility in between states. We made some comments about card design. The way the law was originally set up, the concept really is that the Real ID card is the standard card for every state, and then you end up with maybe some states having the exception with an additional state card. And we're concerned that we'd be allowed to, number one, retain our own state look and feel so that there's not one card, because if you have just one card nationally, that also, once you figure out how to counterfeit that, makes it easier for the counterfeiters. But we're also concerned that the way that it's set up, you have to distinguish your own card with a different color, a different design, and put a lot more work into the card that's not Real ID compliant. So we have some concerns about the requirement for full legal name. Full legal name is a bit difficult proposition because people change their names over the course of their lives. They may decide that they don't like their first name or go by their middle name and last name. Obviously, many women change their name when they get married. Different cultures have different standards for how they establish their full legal name. And there is not one national standard for a full legal name among the various federal databases. So your name could appear in the Social Security database in a different way that it might appear on your passport. And so what we're saying is that it appears to be an undue burden on the states to make them the repository of the full legal name and have to try reconcile these various databases, that it appears more appropriate for the federal government to establish a naming convention that the states can in turn adopt. We have some concerns about the fact that they would ask us to capture the full name history in the barcode. That's the machine readable I'm talking about, our comment number 16. We are 125 characters is not necessarily going to be long enough space to capture a full name history of an individual who may have changed their name several times. So that we're proposing that you really just retain what we do now, which is the full legal name in the machine readable portion of the card. And they're also asking some additional control numbers, other things to be put in the machine readable portion of the card, which we feel are unnecessary and will be difficult to comply with when we move to central issuance, because we won't have a specific inventory number assigned to the card. That happens. The cards are in sheets of plastic, and then the card will be individually cut out without an individual control number assigned. Moving down to comment number 19, we have some questions about this issue of the temporary card. As you know, Oregon has a number of companies that have invested, Japan, for example, that have foreign nationals that come in and out of Oregon on business quite routinely. They may have a two-year visa, but their I-94 may have a shorter expiration. They may be in for 6 months and back out. And so we're concerned that we may be putting many of our business travelers who are here for extended stays in a position of having to renew or get a new license every time the I-94 expires, as opposed to when the visa expires. So we want some clarification. I'm sure we're not the only state with the same problem, where we've got business travelers who are here for extended stays where their I-94s are a shorter duration than their visas. Comment number 20, we have some concerns about the requirement that every time someone renew or replace, that we have to re-verify their data, either with the issuing entity. Either verify the images that we have on file, or have them verify the documents that they return. some people lose their driver licenses within several weeks of getting it, and then we would have to re-verify their data. So we're proposing that we only re-verify at renewal or reissuance if there are changes to the identity source documents, rather than because every time you re-verify, of course, there's also a cost associated with that. Source document retention, number 21. At this point, as I testified earlier, the rules are not specifying that the underlying source documents, which we are, the birth certificate, the Social Security card, et cetera, that we are required to take an image of, it's not requiring that those be exchanged between states, but it is requiring that they be formatted in a transferable format. We're concerned about the exchange between states unless there's a critical need for it. The original reason for the imaging of the documents was to deal with the possibility of fraud, and if there is a possibility of fraud between states, then we feel that law enforcement ought to be the ones that ask for that instead of having this available between states, just between state DMVs. Moving down to database connectivity, number 24, the proposal is requiring that the states check with all other states to make sure that there hasn't been a Real ID issued license before issuing it. Well, that predicates there being such a system in place. There is not a system in place, and it's highly doubtful that there would be a system in place even at the end of the extension period of December of 2009. And so we would propose that that requirement be eliminated until such time as that a database is in place. The same sort of requirement under comment number 25 is that we are to take measures to make sure that the person has terminated their license in another state before issuing a license to them. We understand the principle of one state, one jurisdiction, one license, but until you get a system in place, that's difficult to do. And if you have to terminate your license in California before you apply for your license in Oregon, how are you going to drive to the DMV? It seems a little backwards. The usual process is once you apply for and receive your license in the new state, you are to hand in your driver license from the other state, and then we notify that other state that you have terminated your license with them, and that's the approach that we would propose. Under 26, under their part of their security plan, is that they would have Oregon, if we found a fraudulent driver license from another state, confiscate it. We don't have that kind of authority. I doubt if we could get that kind of authority, so what we're proposing is to do what we do now, is that we would notify the other state that there is a fraudulent driver license there. Under number 27, employee background checks, the proposal is that right now anyone who has or affects the data on the card would have a background check. As I said earlier, we wanted to narrow that definition. But also we'd like to rely on our own existing processes where we've started doing background checks on our field employees. If we're required to do background checks on everyone that is currently employed, we'll obviously get into an issue of bargaining in terms of what do you do with an employee who may have been working for you for 30 years and fails a background check. So what we would propose is that we do background checks, as we do now on employees that we are hiring as they come in. I know this is going to be an issue for a lot of states. Number 29, one of the critical issues, and that's the issue of the deadline. We would like to, they have set now a 2013 deadline for re-enrollment. That's impractical for any state to achieve. And we would propose that be at least 8 years after the beginning of our issuance of Real ID cards, assuming that we would do that starting January 1, 2010. And then also under 30, we're concerned about the fact that the extension for compliance to December 31st, 2009 still is not an adequate amount of time if the federal government intends to have all of the proposed regulations implemented. And so we would ask either that period of time be extended, or they take a very serious look at what they propose in the way of regulations and take a look at the cost versus their ability or efficacy in furthering the intent of the Real ID Act. If there are any other comments that I have that we wrote that you'd like any further information about, I'd be happy to provide that.
Thank you, Ms. Youngs. My first question is, how much discussion did you have with other states in terms of formulating your questions? I guess one of the issues I would have would be how consistent may be some of these comments with other states. Was there some coordination about talking about other concerns and drafting the concerns from your office to the Department of Homeland Security?
Mr. Chair, the American Association of Motor Vehicles held four sessions, one for each of the regions, and we attended the Western Region Conference session, which was in L.A. at the end of the month before last, end of April. At that time, the Department of Homeland Security shared information about the proposed regulations, but it was also an opportunity for states to express their comments. At the same, approximately a week before we finalized our comments, the American Association of Motor Vehicles issued a 53-page comment on the rule. And so we tracked what they had to say. We took a look at what the comments were from other states. So I would imagine that you'll find a high degree of consistency in major comments that you see here.
One of the things that impressed me most notably from reading this last week was that, based on some of the previous testimony you gave, that it really does articulate a lot of unanswered questions and connectivity requirements between other states in terms of being able to meet compliance on a lot of different fronts. And was wondering if, having done further review and with some of the comments that you're forwarding to the Department of Homeland Security, have you made any reassessment in terms of potential cost to the department from your initial estimate of the $70 million? I mean, has there been, as you have gone deeper into some of these proposed rules, has that altered your fiscal as well as perhaps your timeline responses that we discussed a few months earlier?
Mr. Chair, we have not altered our fiscal because it's a high-level fiscal, and it took into consideration all of the requirements of the rules as we knew them, recognizing that we would not be able to get a more refined fiscal until we delved into just what it took to do it. So it really wouldn't have been fruitful to spend the time trying to get a more detailed analysis of something that's still quite ephemeral in many cases. How are we going to know how much it costs to hook up to EVE, the birth certificate system? We just ballparked it until you actually see what it looks like, what its configuration is, how they're actually going to run it. You really can't do anything more than put a placeholder figure based on your experience hooking up to similar systems. So, no, we haven't changed that. As we had stated before, it's going to, with this set of regulations, and if they're going to be expecting full compliance with this proposed set of regulations, it will be very difficult to get that done by 2009, which is the reason why we're proposing they extend it.
Thank you. Questions from the committee for Ms. Youngs?
I have a question. Senator Starr. Thank you. Ms. Youngs, thank you very much for your testimony and the work that you've put into these comments. The question I have is the involvement between your office and the governor's office. Did the governor in any way have any input on the comments that you provided DHS?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we sent the comments over to the governor's office for their review. They did provide some additional input that they had received from the business community, the foreign business community, regarding the comment that we added about immigration status and when would that expire. But in general, they left the comments up to us.
Okay. And then one additional question.
Yeah.
The comment that you have in, I guess it's number 28, employee background checks. And the last sentence, Oregon DMV proposes that this language be revised to cover only those covered employees whose immigration status needs to be verified. How would you determine which covered employees whose immigration status needs to be verified?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, those would be foreign nationals who are not citizens. In other words, if we were employing some individual that were here on an extended work visa, then we would, of course, obviously need to verify their immigration status. But what we're trying to point out is that if you are U.S.-born, SAVE is not going to tell us anything about your immigration status.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Okay, we'll close the informational hearing. on July D and open a public hearing on House Bill 2665. Janet.
House Bill 2665, members, is at the request of the Legislative Action Committee of Community Association Institute, Condominium HOA Working Group, and the Oregon Washington Community Association Managers.
Can you say that again?
I was kind of sorry I started that. The bill establishes new provisions in the Oregon Planned Community Act, and those are the changes to ORS Chapter 94 that are in the beginning half of the bill, and the Oregon Condominium Act, and those are the changes to Chapter 100 that are in the latter half of the bill that relate to voting, electronic communication, appointment of receivers, special meetings, insurance, and reserves. Mr. Chair, there are a number of provisions that are kind of default provisions that will apply only if the governing documents of the association are silent on those issues. And there's a number that apply, several that apply as overriding of existing bylaws. And so we kind of asked the presenter to kind of point those out, the ones that override, because that's more of a policy question and would be unexpected by some of the members of the associations or the condominium associations or communities associations. There are also -A2 amendments, and that should be at your place today, and those were brought by the same coalition of groups. And the -2 amendments say that the condominiums consisting of two or fewer units are exempt from the reserve study and maintenance plan requirements, and the bill right now has that four or fewer units are exempt. So it's a replacement for Section 5 in the original bill, and that's on page 18, so it's a new subsection 5. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Janet.
A2. And there's also in that amendment
emergency clause.
Emergency clause. Actually, it doesn't take an emergency clause because it's going to become effective the 91st day after adjournment.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Kelly Ross, David Bennett, and Denise Bauer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Kelly Ross, representing the Community Associations Institute, the Oregon Washington Community Association Managers, and the Condo Working Group. I hesitate to bring it up, but this bill also passed unanimously in the House, the House Judiciary Committee. And the main reason for that is that a very broad-based group has been meeting for the last year to work on the changes in both of these bills before you this afternoon. Well over two dozen people of varied backgrounds and interests, from attorneys, from members representing homeowners associations, managers of homeowners associations, and brought the bill before you today with me. To answer questions and make some introductory comments is David Bennett, an attorney from Portland that does a lot of work on homeowners association documents. Denise Bauer, who's the chairman of the Legislative Committee of the Community Associations Institute. And also in the audience is Rich Thompson and Greg Coxey and Barbara Kahns, who also worked on this. But I will turn it over to David to make comments and answer your questions.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can review. I think you have a summary of this. If this bill had to do with homeowners,
go ahead and identify yourself for the record first.
I'm sorry. David Bennett. I'm a partner in the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, LLP in Portland.
Thank you.
I've been on this committee, self-appointed, self-important committee, I guess, since 1973 when the Condominium Act was 8 pages long and the Planned Community Act didn't exist. and have been on the committee ever since. I mean, our efforts are try to make better law. Hopefully you make the law, but we suggest what the law might be, and I think that's what we've done this time. The group of people is quite diverse with lots of different interests. The lawyers represent developers, some associations. Our office represents both. Some of the lawyers represent individual owners only, so you have that kind of perspective. And the managers, the insurance agents, the regulators, the architects, and so forth. Yeah. Mr. Chair, would you like me just to go through a quick summary of this?
Please. Or? Please.
All right. Let's take section number two. The first one just adds, one just adds a part of the bill. Number two, establish a procedure for appointment of a receiver if the owners elect or fail to elect a quorum. One of the things that happens when you have a turnover meeting of the association, the developers write the documents, they get approved by the real estate agency if it's a condominium, not if it's a PC, and they're going to be recorded. And those provisions, because of the statute, requires that you have a turnover meeting at some point. Sometimes you have the turnover meeting and the people have ennui and they don't want to elect anybody. And so this says if there's not a quorum there, that then the developer or some individual owner can get a receiver appointed to take over management of the association in that interim. And that occasionally is a problem. Not often, but when it is a problem, it's a real problem, and it's nice just to have the statutory enablement to do that. The second one has to do with insurance deductibles. And we're often asked, in some of my documents I provide how the deductible works, but you may have a deductible of, let's say, $10,000, and you have a loss of common elements or commonly maintained property and to the individual homes, and the question is, how do you allocate that deductible? So this is a provision that would allow that to be done. In addition to that, the amount of the deductible is set out in here. So one thing that happens is, because of the insurance market, you may have a $2,500 deductible that states in your documents that's a maximum you could have, and when you go out to the insurance market, the price is so high for that that it's not reasonable for the association to pay that much. And so our committee came up with a concept of 10,000, notwithstanding what the documents might say. This is, as Ms. Atkins said, one of the overrides, that this goes, even though the documents might say it's $2,500, if the market is such that you can't get insurance. And so the maximum deductible that the board of directors could acquire is $10,000, or a larger amount if Fannie Mae is allowing a larger amount in order to get to the insurance market. Section 4 has to do with electronic communications. It's a modern age. There's a lot of electronic communication back and forth, emails between people, and this facilitates some of that being done and authorizes it. Section 5 is electronic voting. Similarly, under some circumstances, electronic voting can occur. It can't occur for the annual meeting, recall of a director, and so forth, some of those kinds of things. Section number 6 has to do with board meetings. It provides that a director who is present and doesn't speak his or her mind will be deemed to have assented to that action. Also provides that the board has to take minutes, keep minutes, so we can tell who voted against, who voted in favor, or who abstained. 6A has to do...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Duncan.
Can I ask a question? So that just sounds different. Doesn't speak his or her mind. How do you... Who is the judge of whether that... individual spoke his or her mind and assented to the actions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, I think sometimes it happens that associations really don't keep very good records and you don't know really what happened. I think this is an effort, and maybe that was badly put, but it's an effort to force directors in a board of directors to say something, to say, I vote against it, I vote for it, or I abstain. And if there's nothing in the record that says anything about them, then the minutes will reflect they will be deemed to have voted for it. So you know that something passed or something didn't pass because of the voting record. It seems kind of odd, but that does occasionally happen. You have boards of directors that are elected. Somehow they got elected. The individuals, they sit there. They don't want to participate, but they're still there. Whatever it is, they're against it, and they never want to do anything that is positive toward the association operations. And so this is one way to force them either to do something positive or state that they're opposed to something.
Okay. I mean, I don't want to get too deep into, I know homeowner. I mean, I know these are just very negotiated. Do you have formal motions where you have a motion and you do? So nods are happening where you are called upon to vote yes or no. Or
well, Mr. Chair and Senator Decker, that just depends on the association. It depends whether there's a lawyer there to guide them or there's a manager there like Ms. Bauer is there to do that. I've been there where they have the board of directors and they entertain motions from the floor, okay, from the people out in the audience who are owners. So you just never know. If they have someone there that's a professional, they can guide them. But sometimes you really don't have. What you're really trying to do is get it to function, even though they do it in an informal kind of way. And that's what all of this is about, is trying to make sure that these associations can function. Our office represents several hundred, 800 or 900 homeowners associations. So in addition to drafting documents, sometimes I represent associations. I've drafted the documents 4 years ago, and I'm a little bit ashamed of it, but I try to learn from some of that. Rich Vile's office represents more associations than we do, so they see a lot of those kinds of things. And our effort is to try to make it function for people. Okay. Section 6A is the contents of the declaration requires that there be a maintenance plan and that the developer promulgate that maintenance plan and make it part of the declaration. The Condominium Act provides that now. Part of what we're doing in some of these things is trying to make the Planned Community Act and the Condominium Act parallel. And maybe you know what a condominium is and a planned community. Sometimes you can't tell the difference. You look at it, it might be a planned community with lots that actually own the lot, but it's just a single building and common property, common roof, and we call that commonly maintained property. And they will also usually have an association, and you have a condominium. So in this instance, we're trying to make sure that those are parallel. In both of them, the maintenance plan is required, and in the Planned Community Act, the declarant wasn't required to promulgate that, and now he is. Section 7 has to do with some revisions to the reserve plan. Currently, the reserve study requires that you have a reserve to make replacements for anything that lasts longer than 3 and more than 30 years. If it's less than 3, you're not required to reserve for it currently. And so if it's within 1 year, it ought to be in your operating budget. But if it's between 12 months and 36 months, it doesn't have to be reserved for. But suddenly, come 36 months, you have to replace it. And so this is now saying the reserve study has to include, and you have to provide funds for everything from 1 year to 30 years. On the turnover meeting, this again specifying when there's a quorum for that. Prescribes procedures to elect directors. 8A has to do with the budget, and it clarifies that there has to be the budget has to include reserves. Sometimes developers are always really concerned about having the assessment low in the first instance because they're trying to market their units, and so they have the assessment low and they don't put any reserve allocations in there. And this is a requirement. The Condominium Act does require it. Here it requires that your budget include money for the reserves. The next issue has to do with votes by written ballot. It clarifies some of the procedures, some of the secrecy procedures, and also expands some of the exceptions when you can't have a vote by written ballot. And again, that's where you're going to recall a director, what have you. There's also provisions that you can count the ballots if a secrecy ballot is not required. Some associations, for example, Sun River, says you've got to vote by secret ballot. Most associations don't have that, but in either a condominium or planned community, if 10% of the people request to vote by secret ballot, then you're required to vote by secret ballot. And so this carries that out as well. Calling of special meetings, it clarifies that if someone requests that, if a certain number of owners request it, that the officers have to call the meeting, and if they fail to do so, it gives authority to the person who requested the meeting to call the meeting themselves. The next item has to do with the reduced quorum. There's often a problem in associations where you have a quorum that's 50%, and you never can get 50%, no action can be taken. So if they call a meeting and the quorum isn't present, they can adjourn the meeting, and the quorum then is cut in half. Section 12 has to do with voting rights of fiduciaries. It just clarifies when a fiduciary can vote, how they vote, and also clarifies that the fiduciary can consent to things. So in some instances, an owner, you can't do something without the owner's consent. In this situation, it would provide that the fiduciary can consent. On the method of voting, It again restructures some of that. It prohibits any required proxy form. Sometimes boards of directors will come out and say, you got to use our proxy, don't use our proxy, then it doesn't count. We would advise our association clients that that's not proper, but this now statutorily supports that. Back into the insurance deductibles, we talked about that earlier, that sometimes the market is such you just can't obtain insurance, and that's in order to take care of that. Section 15 adds to the bylaws and documents must include certain provisions related to insurance. That can be in the declaration of the bylaws. Now it says it has to be there. In 16, it's kind of a parallel provision with respect to responsibility for payment of the amount of the deductible I talked about earlier and trying to allocate who pays for that. 17 has to do with an attorney's fees provision. Some developers have taken recently to restricting any of the association taking any action, any legal action, and spending legal fees in excess of $5,000 without a 75% vote. So it's restricting some of the construction defect litigation, other litigation against the owners. If the board of directors believes that it's prudent to hire a lawyer to spend more than that, and in any litigation, you're going to spend more than that. I personally have been involved in some of that situation where the board threw up its hands and didn't take action against the developer when they probably should have because of that restriction. So this is saying, notwithstanding that, that doesn't bind people. 19, the status of your appointment of the receiver. If the owners fail to elect a quorum, we talked about that before. Some of these provisions now in the Condominium Act are parallel. We talked about electronic communications, electronic voting, board members, reserve studies. All of those are kind of parallel. This, in Section 23, there's a provision that you don't have to have a reserve study if you have four units or less. I think one of the legislators was concerned about that, that lives in a two-unit condominium, and that's an expensive kind of thing. So that was put in there at four, and I think there's an amendment that Ms. Atkins talked about that it goes down to two. So in a two-unit condominium, you don't have to have a reserve study, but in a three- or four-unit, you have. And that our committee looked at that and felt like, I'm one person in there, they don't have a reserve study, they're not funding for reserves, and you know, when we get there, we got to put the roof on, we don't have the $15,000, $20,000 to do that. That in a two-unit it's fine, in a three-unit or more we ought to have that. Section 24 again has to do with a quorum at a turnover meeting. Section 25 parallel again with respect to calling a special meetings. 26 is the quorum required again, the reduced quorum in the event that you're unable to get a quorum. 26A is just a little bit deleting some language that's inconsistent with the other provisions with respect to budgets. 27 is more clarification on the votes by written ballot, when you can do that, when you can't. 28, again, some clarification on voting, again, restricting the board of directors from requiring a specific form of proxy. 29, parallel with respect to the attorney's fees. 30 has to do with recording the bylaws. I think that's within 2 years after they're approved. And we have seen some bylaws approved late, and they never were recorded. And 10 years later, we've been presented, and they said we could record them now, and maybe the law has changed on that. 31 is a parallel provision with respect to insurance deductibles. 32, this is parallel to what I've said before in the Planned Community Act. This is the Condo Act. 32 is parallel with respect to the rights of fiduciaries to vote. 33 under the Planned Community Act is there was some confusion before with respect to the application of certain provisions of legislation when it became effective, and this is just to clarify that. So that's that bill. I think the next bill you have, we're going to be up again, but
we'll do that one at that moment.
You have this
just briefly then on the Dash A2 amendment,
if you could comment on that
A2.
Two things on that. One was reducing from four to two the requirement, the exception for reserve study, and then the provision that the effective date is 91 days after the end of the legislative session as opposed to January 1st. And the reason for that request is that there's some things with respect to homeowner association operations that are a problem now, the deductible kind of an insurance and some other kinds of things. We felt that was sufficiently important that we ought to get it started as soon as possible.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Bennett. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On sections 4 and 5, I think there are some duplication sections in the back, but I'm trying to understand a little bit more about the electronic notification, if I could. In your comments, I thought you mentioned that that electronic email type voting wouldn't be allowed under bylaw changes and election of officers, but I didn't see that in there, or maybe I misunderstood you. Because I noticed that there are certain things that where it cannot be given, which is failure to pay an assessment, foreclosure, action of the association may take against the owner, but I thought you said something about bylaw changes couldn't be done by email.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I kind of went through it all quickly. I may have misspoken.
Maybe I just misunderstood you.
I looked directly at what section was that?
I think it was under Section 5, but it was 4 and 5. And I'm just trying to figure out, it seems like to me, especially on bylaw changes, it seems electronic. I'm just trying to figure out
I didn't mean to say bylaw changes.
I may have misheard you.
I don't think that's one of the exceptions.
Okay. All right. Another question, if I could.
Yeah.
I'm just going to assume it's not there then. On section 11 and 26, we just have a discussion about the quorum. And in these sections, I guess what has me concerned is this cutting this quorum in half. And there's a reason why we have quorum rules. Can you explain to me kind of the logic of why we would kind of... It looks like to me that the way that it's structured is that if you don't have a quorum, you adjourn the meeting, then you come back and only half the quorum is needed. So explain to me why that's necessary, and that's kind of a dangerous step. And I just want to make sure that there's some kind of justification behind that.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, sometimes it might be a dangerous step, but I think the concern is that inaction is a more dangerous step. There's so much ennui, I guess is a good French word for it, that people just, they're not interested. Nothing can happen. Nothing's happening. They've got to approve the budget. You can't assess anything unless the budget is approved by the association. So there they sit. The board is required to raise funds to replace things and maintain them, and you can't do that. You can't elect the board of directors because you can't get enough people interested, let alone people who might want to run. So it's the balance between the paralysis that association has because they have some real high quorum requirements and the circumstances where a smaller quorum might be the minority is going to dictate, so the tyranny of the minority. So, part of that is it indicates it doesn't fall below 20%. For example, a duplex condominium, I provide the things have to be unanimous. And then we have some arbitration, some mediation kinds of requirement. If I have a 10-unit condominium, I will provide that the quorum, is probably a majority of the owners in order to do that. But, if you have Mountain Park, for example, has like 33,000, 3,500 members, and the quorum requirement is 20%. I don't remember what I do represent that association. I forget what the quorum requirements are. But if you have a high quorum requirement, they're never going to meet it. So it really has more to do with the large scale associations where they just nobody's interested and they can't get anything done.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only fairness on Senator George's that you would have is that you have that tyranny of the minority on the other side where you have like one or two board, and I just don't know enough about how homeowner associations operate, but I guess the only fear that I would have is that you get a couple of board members and they are able to, my understanding is, operate on behalf of the homeowner association or condominium association. And so I'd hate for them to call a meeting, cut the quorum down in half, and assess a fee to clean up and beautify the association, and now it is the law of the land in that homeowner association or condominium association. So I guess that's the only fear that I have, and I'm drawing upon one experience where my mother lived in one of these and had a few board members who they all had to kind of keep their eyes on because they were assessing fees and taking down mailboxes and doing all this activity that I thought I'll never want to be in a homeowners association my entire life based on watching that one experience. So that would be the only fear I have with kind of cutting a quorum down. Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, if I might respond to that. First of all, my wife said, we're going to live in a condominium when we get old, and I said, we are old and we're never going to live in a condominium. I agree with you with respect to that. Secondly, we're talking about a quorum of the association, not a quorum of the board of directors.
Okay,
the board,
this
has to do with the owner's meeting, at the owner's meeting.
Okay, okay.
So one of the things that happens, if you can't get a quorum and nothing's going on, then this would reduce that so you could make some decisions. Now, having made a decision, if that's something that most of the people are unhappy about, politically they ought to get together and call another meeting and have a larger group of people that vote against it. And we do see that from time to time.
Okay.
But, I mean, I think the risk is that nothing's going to get done is a greater risk than we're going to go too far. And I grant you, you know, a lot of the associations represent, we have very active chairs that want to go out and think, you know, they've been appointed a dictator. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, you have a board that doesn't want to do anything. It's a tension in a limiting association. That's why I don't, it's bad enough to, you know, live in a law firm.
Okay, so, I guess so it does not affect, this wouldn't be board members.
It's not board members.
Right.
Senator Stark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to kind of pile on the personal experience here situation. I live in one homeowners association. My wife was the president of it for a number of years, and so I understand the challenge of getting homeowners to the annual. Basically, it's a one annual meeting when we try to get everybody there. Unless there's something going obviously upside down with the association, it's like pulling teeth to get people to show up at these once a year kind of meetings. And so while it makes a person nervous, makes me nervous, I understand that the rationale and need to have a process in place that an association can operate under. There are decisions that have to be made. There are budgets that have to be approved. Ultimately, there's responsibility that the board has to do business, and at least in the homeowners association in which I live, it's not without the homeowner's knowledge that a meeting's going on. The board does a terrific job of informing the homeowners that, you know, next Tuesday night at 7 o'clock at so and so a place, there's going to be your annual meeting, and with signs going in and out of every entrance to the subdivision, and newsletters and whatnot. So at least in the one that I live in and the one that my wife was the president of for a number of years, I understand the rationale for this particular change to the statute.
Thank you, Senator. Yeah, I think we've all experienced that. It's and usually if in a situation, whether it's a board of directors or the group of any group, if somebody does something they don't like, and then all of a sudden there is renewed enthusiasm to show up the next meeting to correct that. I know when I was a board member of Portland Teacher Credit Union, now On Point Credit Union, we always had our annual meeting, had one of the biggest turnouts of credit union members. It's always packed, you know, with 400 people in there. But there's 150,000 members of the credit union, so a quorum of members would never be totally impossible. So. Senator George, you had a question.
Yeah, I want to follow up, if I could, on a question that Senator Deckard asked earlier in Section 6 on the assenting to the action. And we could expand that a little bit. Why is it currently right now that if a motion comes before a board, is there not a vote taken? What environment happens where people are allowed to keep quiet if they're on the board of directors? Why is that happening right now?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think I might let Denise Bauer answer that, since she runs a lot of these board meetings. We don't usually attend unless she thinks that somebody's going to threaten her, I guess. But these are not sometimes sophisticated people who are running this. They don't have the experience of serving in the Senate and going through these kinds of processes. They're just sitting there, well, what do you think about that? Oh, I guess that would be okay. You know, what do you think? And all of a sudden, well, let's go. I guess it's all right. And you don't know what the minutes are, and so this is trying to get some certainty to what those decisions were. And so if something was proposed and voted on, then you're going to say, well, I guess it passes. I'll let Ms. Bauer, if I might, respond to that as well.
Please identify yourself for the record, and then please respond.
I'm Denise Bauer with Community Management Incorporated. I'm the chair of the Legislative Action Committee for Community Association Institute, which is a national organization. Chair Metzger, Senator George, basically he stated what is true. It is somewhat, maybe not as professional as it should be sometimes, because you are dealing with homeowners who don't get paid and who don't necessarily know parliamentary procedure. Parliamentary procedure does allow you to do things by general consent without objection. And it's easy to run over somebody. And you can say, without objection, we're going to approve the tot lot to be upgraded for $500. And basically what this is saying is, unless you speak up, you're going to be counted as an assent vote. So at that point, you need to say, objection, I want to be put in the minutes as abstaining or as opposing the particular action that's being taken. Not always are there formal motions made. For some reason, people have a problem with making that motion and getting that second on the floor before discussion. They seem to put the cart before the horse, and they like to do the discussion, and then when they're all through with the discussion, that's when they do the motion. And that's, no matter how many times you tell them they get a motion on the floor, it's difficult sometimes, because they are homeowners. This is their home. This is where their heart and their money is. So,
if I could, maybe you could, how will people know that this applies to them, I guess? I mean, if they're already not very sophisticated, they're sitting in a group, they get elected to a board, they're sitting in a group of five of their neighbors, they're the sixth person or seventh person, and all of a sudden the chair says, we're going to move something. How do they know that they have an affirmative obligation to say something? Most people would assume that I was going to vote on something. You know, most unsophisticated people get elected to a board, they would assume they're going to vote on something, and when a vote's not called, how are they going to know that there's a state law that says you just voted yes? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm a little concerned about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think the issue comes out later on when somebody says, hey, I don't think that was effective. You know, was that actually approved? And so rather than sit there and not know whether or not you have an effective decision, it's after the fact that it comes to us. She calls our office and said, somebody's objecting to this. This wasn't properly decided. And those are issues that are often raised, not just from a vote, but for anything. Is this really effective? Do I have to comply with this? Was this change made? Was the budget approved? Did we agree that we were going to grant this easement and what have you? And so you can go back and say, well, it was put up there. The board of directors approved it. The minutes say they approved it. And so this guy, well, I didn't vote, I didn't do whatever, and then it's going to say, well, you are deemed to have assented to that because you didn't say anything.
Gotcha. Okay, I understand now. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Bauer, do you have anything you need to add? Okay. Any other questions?
Just one brief. There is definition in statute between a duplex and a condominium, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I'm not sure exactly what your question is. If you have a duplex, a duplex is just a building that has two residential units.
Exactly.
And so that duplex can be a planned community if it's on separate lots, and we decide that we're going to have a planned community and there'll be commonly maintained property. Sometimes I'll take a duplex in separate lots and I'll just have a party wall agreement between them. There'll be no association. In some circumstances, you have a duplex where you can't divide it physically into lots, either because of the zoning or it's upstairs downstairs situation, and so in order to divide it into two interests, you have to make a condominium out of it. So you're not a condominium unless you file a condominium declaration, bylaws, and a condominium plat, and then you're a condominium. And both the sale documents have to be approved by the real estate agency, and the declaration, bylaws, and plat have to be approved by the agency, and the plat has to be approved by the county surveyor before it can be recorded.
I just want to make sure that when I was reading this that it wasn't going to have some influence over quadruplexes, what are those called? Quadruplexes.
Co-ops.
And the triplexes and the duplexes.
Oh,
but this is strictly condominiums, and therefore it's its own statute, and it has to be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, that is correct.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2665. Open a work session with an A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A2 amendment to House Bill 2665.
Senator Starr has moved the dash A2 amendment to House Bill 2665. Questions on the amendment? Any objections? Order. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2665 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a further discussion? Any objections? Order. Anybody would like to carry this bill? Okay, I will. Okay, while you're there, we'll open up a public hearing to House Bill 2666. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2666 is the same groups that brought the bill and the same work on it. There aren't as many parallels as there are. There are some different statutes applying to different. But again, if it's Chapter 94, it's the planned communities. If it's Chapter 100, they're the condominiums. This does have an A2 amendment. The only effect of the A2 amendment on 2666 is the 91st day applicability. There is some language in the bill that establishes specifics about windows and unit access doors being general common elements of a condominium, but the glazing and the screens being part of individual units, so that the association is responsible for maintenance, repair, and replacement of the common elements, and that's where that comes in. And there's some provisions about converting leaseholds to a fee condominium after 75% of the owner's approval, even if the bylaws require approval of more individuals. So that's one of the overriding type provisions in this bill. And, Mr. Chair, it requires an association with more than four units to be incorporated and permits a board to incorporate previously unincorporated association, notwithstanding anything provided by the bylaws. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Mr. Bennett, if you'd re-identify yourself for the record and then maybe just give us the highlights of 2666.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. David Bennett, I'm a lawyer and partner in the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, LLP in Portland. This is House Bill 2666A. Section number one adds the concept of other governing documents as a source of requirement for assessment obligations. One of the things that happens in the so-called row homes that you may have seen where there isn't any declaration, they got common walls, they got a common roof, and there's really no way to kind of maintain it, but somehow they have some architectural guidelines, they have some rule, some other kind of document that says this is the power of assessment. So this is simply saying that if you have another document, governing document, other than a declaration or bylaws, and that gives you the power of assessment, that this is it's a legitimate way to assess for the common expenses. The second part of that revises the definition of common property to include as common property that which is designated on the plat as common property. You may have a declaration that doesn't state that there's any common property. You may not even have a declaration, but you have a plat that has a tract on it. So this is making it clear that that tract is common property and is maintained by the association. Section 2 has to do with incorporation. One of the issues that we often run into in small associations, those who were done a long time ago, that are planned communities, not condominiums, is that there isn't any association and there is some liability with people in unincorporated associations that they don't have if they're incorporated. And so this would allow the board of directors to say, we're going to incorporate, notwithstanding that there isn't, that we don't comply with the provisions of the our documents with respect to how many people it takes to incorporate. 2A conforms to the Oregon Condominium Act, the right of association to intervene in litigation. The Condominium Act provides that the Board of Directors has the authority in behalf of the association to intervene or institute litigation with respect to the common properties and with respect to the units with an opt-out provision. And the Planned Community Act doesn't have that kind of thing. There are some cases in Oregon. There's currently a case pending before the Supreme Court. Rich Vile, who's not here, actually argued that case. The Court of Appeals held that the association didn't have the authority to bring an action with respect to the commonly maintained property, and that's the Supreme Court granted cert on that, and that's pending decision. It's been argued. So this makes it clear that with respect to commonly maintained property, the association is the proper party plaintiff to bring an action with respect to that. Section 3 simply says that these provisions are added to the Condominium Act. Section 4 provides that there can be certain amendments by the declarant to comply with Fannie Mae and other lenders. Most of us write our documents that way, that the developer has a unilateral right of amendment in order to amend the documents to comply with the requirements of the secondary mortgage market. So this is statutorily giving that authority with the lawyers who don't draft these kind of provisions. Section 5 removes the definition of dwelling unit from the start of the Condominium Act and places it back in that section with a special definition where you have condominium conversions, because the concept of dwelling unit only applies in that section, whereas its definition is under Chapter 90 with the Residential Landlord Tenant Act. The other section there has to do with a default provision that windows, doors, are part of the commonly maintained property except for the glazing, unless the documents provide otherwise. A lot of us write our documents otherwise because it's a big expense for the association to maintain the windows. On the other hand, the tension is that sometimes when you're going to replace all the windows at once, it's better to have the association. So that's one of the debates that we had on our committee. But if it's not stated, then it becomes a common element. Section 6, the first part of that, allows a condominium unit to be subdivided, and that comes about, for example, I represented Multnomah County in drafting a condominium project which consisted of two units, a branch library in Hollywood, and above it was a 40-unit apartment complex. So there's only two units. That 40-unit apartment complex is a condominium unit. So this would make it clear that you could subdivide that into condominiums. So that's kind of where that is there. So the next section, 6, I guess we talked about that. The second part of 6 exempts non-residential units from the foreclosure statement. That's the way we look at it, but that clarifies it. Section 7 is the leasehold provision, and that's something that's near and dear to my heart. I represent 5 associations that are leasehold projects. It says that you can't amend the declaration except on 100% vote. The leases are getting short now with respect to like 28 years, and we need to be able to submit the fee interest to the condominium form of ownership. In each of those, there is an option to purchase. Some of the people aren't going to be able to purchase, so we need to be able to submit it. And you know anything, having been in the business you are, you know that it's really hard to get unanimous agreement on the part of anybody. So this allows that condominium declaration, the fee interest, to be submitted to the condominium form of ownership so those options can be exercised. Section 8 is sort of a technical thing with respect to the square footage, to be sure that's clear. Section 10, that's the dwelling unit issue again. Section 11 has to do with the incorporation issue again and the granting of easements. Section 12 clarifies what the 203 amendments applied to. Section 13, again, the bylaws need to be recorded within 2 years so they don't sit out there forever having been approved and not recorded. Section 14 is a definition of unit boundaries, and it says here's what the default provision is with respect to that and clarifies that a little bit. Section 15 provides unit owners are responsible for maintaining their unit unless otherwise stated. 16 is the parallels. The common elements are maintained by the association unless otherwise stated. Section 21 is just a technical issue on the timeshare, and that's it. If there are any questions, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Thank you for reviewing. Questions for Mr. Bennett? Well, I really appreciate all the work that's been done in the interim. We had some of these issues last year. They just kind of blew up, primarily just because there just was more minds that had to be put together and working on the product, and I really appreciate all the work that's been done on the interim on that. If there's no other further questions, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2666, open work session, and we have a dash.
Mr. Chair, move the dash A2 amendment to House Bill 2666.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 2A2 amendment to House Bill 2666. Questions? Senator Monis Anderson.
Implementation won't be a problem with this A2 amendment. This act takes effect the 91st day, 3 months.
I guess so.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I don't think it's going to be a problem. You know, our office has like 100 developments under various sorts of processes, and it doesn't make a difference if it's the effective date is January or 91 days. We're going to have to conform all of our documents to that. So, and there's some provisions with respect to association operations. The other bill, it's important. This, I think, works the same way. It's going to be an issue. We're going to have to change our documents anyway. 91st day or January, I don't think makes any difference.
Okay. Just follow. It just seems like 3 months is a pretty short period of time to get all your forms in place. But you had requested this amendment, so you want it to be implemented quickly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I probably have as many projects as anybody in the state, and I think I can get it done.
Good. Thank you.
Any other questions? Any objections to the amendment?
So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2666 as amended to Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2666 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Please mark Senator Deckard as excused, and I guess I'll be carrying the duo. I won't ask on this one. Okay. Guess what we're going back to next? Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2538. Janet.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2538 is at the request of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association and would require the Landscape Contractors Board, to establish continuing education requirements for landscape contractors of up to 10 hours per year, requiring landscape contractors that submit applications for renewal of their license on or before January 1st, 2009, to demonstrate compliance with the continuing education requirement. There is an emergency clause on the bill, and a number of people signed up to testify.
Okay, John Stone and Bill Cross, please.
Mr. Committee.
Well, Mr. Committee.
Committee members, my name is Bill Cross. For the record, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and gratefully, my main job is to introduce the state president of the association, John Stone.
Mr. Stone, welcome again.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is John Stone. I own J.P. Stone Contractors. My company provides landscape contracting services in the Portland area. I also serve as the current president of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and on its behalf, I request your support of HB 2538. This legislation authorizes the Landscape Contractors Board to establish continuing education requirements for individual landscape contractors. Currently, once an individual has successfully passed the competency examination to become licensed with the LCB, there are no requirements for continued education. The license is, in essence, a lifetime license, even though landscape technology has drastically changed and continues to do so. In an effort to increase the skill and knowledge within the landscape construction industry, HB 2538 would require individual landscape contractors to obtain up to 10 hours of continuing education a year through attendance at classes, industry meetings and trade shows, community college education, and online education. This is becoming an important issue to the landscape industry as it has transitioned over the past 15 years from a seasonal business to one that is year-round. The skills and knowledge necessary to run a landscape contracting business are tenfold what they were. Individuals and companies that do not require ongoing education are a risk to the public and industry for the following reasons. I'm going to go through these a little bit quickly in the interest of time. I'll be glad to answer any specific questions. But, for instance, human resources has become a much more complicated area for all businesses. Safety concerns through OSHA requirements and general safety interests are much more complicated than they were. Water management in particular with regard to clean water, conservation of water, the amount of land that landscape contractors affect in terms of its water use and cleanliness, general technology. Almost all of the work that we do requires greater use of technology than it has in the past. general environmental protections with regard particularly to chemicals, stormwater runoff, pesticides, fertilizers, sophisticated equipment to implement landscape installations have all become more complicated. Prior to introduction of this legislation, FOLCA surveyed its members on a variety of proposed legislative issues. Most of the members of OLCA are small and medium-sized businesses, and 70% of the 35% who responded supported the continuing education proposal. This is a good response in our industry. It should also be noted that 90% of the board of directors operate small and medium-sized businesses, and they voted unanimously to introduce this legislation. The Landscape Contractors Board, in the attached letter dated March 19th, has described the process that would be implemented by rule to approve potential continuing education opportunities. There currently exists many free and or inexpensive education opportunities, from trade shows to educational classes to vendor-sponsored informational presentations that would satisfy the continuing education requirements being proposed and offered to licensees. As smaller business operators, we do not support the creation of costly and onerous regulations for licensees and do not believe that HB 2538 will have that result. Just as with the construction industry, the public and landscape construction industry need to be proactive regarding education. Relying on a volunteer system for education does not serve either well. Requiring continuing education will help promote consumer protection, individual competency, and a more professional industry. There are many other industries and professions that already require continuing education, and the public professions benefit from it. The Oregon Landscape Contractors Association believes the landscape industry will serve the public better once the permit and inspection process is not required for landscape, since the permit and inspection process is not required for landscape construction work in Oregon. Continued education promotes consumer confidence, consumer protection, and a positive, respected consumer perspective of the landscape industry as good stewards of Oregon's land and natural resources. Passage of HB 2538 will help enhance consumer and environmental protection. We urge your adoption. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. Questions for Mr. Stone. Senator Mona Sanderson.
When you get your landscape contractor's license, is that given only in English?
I don't think it is. I think it's available in Spanish now. It was in English when I took it.
I hear people shaking their heads in the back.
No.
Well, if somebody knows, come on up. You can't speak from the back. Please come up forward just so we can have you on the record as opposed to the voice in the back of the room. And identify yourself, please.
For the record, my name is Mike Snyder. I'm the administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board. Currently, the exam is given only in English, but you can have a translator there to translate it into Spanish if you desire.
Okay, just to follow up then, is this going to be a problem for and I don't know how many we have, for those landscape contractors to get continuing education?
There's a growing body of available education in Spanish in the field in the sources that we've outlined here in my earlier testimony.
Great. That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Other questions? Any questions for this group? Okay. Thank you. So I have to get a couple of the opponents up here. Wes Butler and Stephanie Ulibarri. To you.
I'm Wes Butler from Silverton. I've been a landscape contractor since 1980. I've been in the industry for about 32 years in two states. I'm going to urge a no vote on HB 2538. I don't believe that it will in any way guarantee better craftsmanship or the fulfillment of contractual obligations of a landscape contractor to a client who should be hiring a service based on reputation and character in the first place. Continuing to be informed in all areas of life is always a good idea, but not as a mandate by the state. This bill will be an added burden on small and larger businesses alike. The time and money involved are going to be adding to the stack of regulations that small business must comply with. This bill does not enhance the moral character or integrity of any landscape business. This bill will, without a doubt, increase costs to the LCB contractor and ultimately the consumer who is paying for the increasing cost of government regulation in business. I'm sure there's a lot more that I could say, but I do urge a no vote on this, HB 2538, and I believe it will be for the goal of protecting free enterprise, affordable private services, and to minimize unnecessary government obligation to enforce new regulation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Ms. Uliberry.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Uliberry. I'm the wife of Jameson Uliberry of Sunlit Landscapes, who, being a swamped landscaper, wasn't sure he'd be able to make it here, so I'm here to represent our concerns. We are opposed to the increasing of unnecessary regulation on the smallest businesses that HB 2538 would mandate for a number of reasons. Primarily, it is already hard enough to establish a new business, and this bill would make it even harder. This would reduce competition in the marketplace, favoring the larger, well-established business, and thereby discouraging startups. Classes are costly both in money and or time off of work. Now, we're not against education. My husband, who is the licensed contractor, at this point does seek to take classes to have better knowledge of the areas that he is working in, but the requirements of this bill would limit our ability to make our own educational decisions. For example, my husband has sent workers to take classes as needed when they were the ones that needed the greater education, and that would not, he wouldn't get credit for that, according to the bill. Other times he may plan on taking a class, but then schedule conflicts arise and make attendance to the class difficult or impossible. And so this bill would limit much needed schedule flexibility. Some additional points are the added cost to the landscaper would increase cost to the consumer. The bill does not recognize the hours, and I can testify to the hours and hours and hours of self-education going through books and internet study. It does not recognize the continuing education naturally gained from on-the-job work. And sometimes the time loss expense is multiplied when the crew can't work without the foreman because he's at the class, so the money's lost to both the business and the worker. So overall, the bill would have a significant cost to the consumer and industry, but a very small benefit, if any. Now, on a personal note, I'd like to tell you briefly how we came to be a respected, reasonably successful landscape company. My husband and I were basically homeless early on in our marriage, and he was given a small little beater truck, and he borrowed a lawnmower. And with those, he started mowing lawns and weeding yards. Over the course of 8 years, it became a successful yard maintenance business. And so when we moved to the Valley, he decided to step up the business to become a licensed landscape contractor. And he's been at this now for 7 years as a licensed contractor. In those early years, a bill like this would have been a great hardship, as both money and time were very scarce. And we want others to have the opportunity to succeed as we did, and this bill would prevent that for many people. The last hearing, my husband made a point saying that the strongest case of the affirmative side showed a need for education pertaining to things like water conservation, as the gentleman before specified, but this bill doesn't address that issue and would do nearly nothing to solve that problem. And so we feel that surely there must be some reasonable alternatives if there are the water conservation and the safety kind of issues. And also I'd like to inform you of the opposition that turned out for the last hearing, which was not quite at the big spring rush, which many contractors simply can't get away from their work at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Ulibarri. Let me just ask you a couple questions, because what the bill calls for is not more than 10 hours a year. So that would be one long day sometime in the 365 days, or perhaps a couple of afternoons at some point. Some might suggest that's not exactly overbearing. You're talking about the cost to the consumer, and I understand that, conflicts, getting difficulty, but I think, couldn't we not apply that to just about everybody that comes to the committee who's an electrical contractor, a general contractor, a remodeler, could all say the same thing. I guess I just would like to have you clarify why this might be different from any other type of contract licensee who comes before us about the various requirements for their profession.
Your comment, Les.
Chair Metzger, committee, if I could just address that. I think this is a philosophically a bigger issue than comparing to other trades. I'm not here to speak specifically for my own business and my friends and my own family, but philosophically, we do have a free country, and we do have a free marketplace. And the direction that I see business and the government moving is that the consumer has a tendency to believe they are safe because of the state and the state regulations, when in fact there are so many loopholes in many of these laws and regulations that they sort of go in a blind sort of way, believing that they're already protected, when the responsibility really is on the consumer to research and network and to find out who they're doing business with. And so it's sort of a bigger philosophical issue for me. I would probably benefit by this bill passing, because it would keep some of the smaller businesses out of my way. It would keep people that are starting up out of my way to some extent. And so I could benefit financially from this bill passing. But philosophically, I'm opposed to it, because it's not moving us or continuing us in a free marketplace type situation. So it sort of opens a bigger discussion into whether all of the other trades should even be doing some of the things that they are required to do.
Okay. Questions for these two?
Yeah. I look at it more as from a safety issue, one, and now more research is out on pesticide use and the correct usage of pesticides. And so I would think knowledge like that, how would you get that unless you went through some training? And then with new, new technology, et cetera, I'm worried about, say, the environment and drainage issues, or the types. There are certain shrubbery that are better at, with the new plants that are coming forth, some grow better at some elevations than others. How do you then learn about that? Is that
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, it's my understanding that the bill does not specify anything about what classes you're to be taking.
Mm-mm.
And so it doesn't really address those issues. We are concerned. Our business does seek to, we don't care to use pesticides or chemicals at all in our business. We go with people that are certified chemical applicators for that. As well as, these are issues, I believe that much of this is, as Mr. Butler said, a consumer issue that can be, they will weed out the ones that are not knowledgeable. They're not going to be continuing. I'm losing my train of thought here. I just don't see that the bill really addresses those issues specifically.
Just follow. I know in order to be competitive in the marketplace, you're going to have to do things right.
Right.
I realize that. But there are, I think, from a liability point of view, things that you, I would think continuing education may help. Again, I'm a nurse. I'm not a landscaper. So I would think, and they don't require continuing education for nurses here, so in the state of Oregon, which they should, but be that as it may. But like drainage problems, and there's new ways of taking care of some of the drainage problems on landscape. Maybe you just find that out on your own rather than saying, oh, this is something that I need. I would like some education on.
Senator Anderson, that is an issue that my husband, when he comes across a new or a difficult issue, one that he's dealt with before, but this one has a little twist to it, he has spent many, many hours, because he wants to do a good job. He wants to do right by his customers. And I don't think, well, he spends much time educating himself, for which he would get no credit for.
Any questions for these two? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, we have Jill, looks like, is it Hoyinga? Patrick Griffiths and Judy Ranton. And I'll let whoever would like to start begin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jill Hoyenga from the Eugene Water and Electric Board in Eugene, Oregon. We're the water utility for the City of Eugene, but we're not the City of Eugene. We're a different agency. Eugene Water and Electric Board has a mission to provide a mission to reliably deliver quality water and to assure adequate supply. And in order to fulfill this mission, we have qualified professionals, and we require CEUs so that they can stay abreast of the latest and newest technologies to assist them in their work. And that's, so there's a CEU requirement for that. Water demand and customer piping greatly impacts the way that EWEB must build out infrastructure, and we partner with plumbers and backflow assembly testers, and those two professions require CEUs, and so that they can stay abreast of the most up-to-date practices in their fields to assist us as a public utility in our mission of reliably delivering quality water and ensuring adequate supply. Landscape and irrigation contractors and their practices have presented increasing challenges to water utilities throughout the United States. And I'm only going to be able to speak to the experience at Eugene Water and Electric Board today, because I like to speak from personal experience rather than generalizations. It's become clear that education, specifically in irrigation contractors, is going to be essential to be able to effectively fulfill our mission of delivering quality water and assuring adequate supply at a reasonable cost. We provide a lot of this professional training already. We are certified instructors in the backflow assembly field already for our utility staff to be able to train local testers And we also are going to have a train the trainer session in October to train for irrigation association classes. And those are subsidized classes, and they're offered in the winter when there's not as much work happening. And we invite all of the licensed landscape contractors to attend those classes. And the huge mailing that we made this last winter, we had 8 show up. Okay, so it's really hard to get people to just show up. And some of the issues that the specific case that I'm going to speak to in my testimony is a issue where there is irrigation demands 3 days of the week for 2 hours of each day, each of those 3 days. So there's 48 hours of demand a year that's going to require millions of dollars of infrastructure build-out for us to meet that demand. The solution to this is simply education. We had a case study with 158 customers, and we were able to communicate low and no-cost solutions to that hourly peak challenge to our system, and we're able to defer $500,000 of build-out for those 158 customers. That was an experiment that we were testing our belief that education can make a big difference. We wanted to roll that out to the contractors, and only 8 showed up. And so we have a very large challenge because this case study is actually a microcosm of the challenge to our whole distribution system. And it's going to cost many, many millions of dollars to build the infrastructure to meet those 48 hours of demand. I believe those millions of dollars would be better spent on other things, and a fraction of those millions of dollars would be paid, paying for CEUs, and even the customers that are having to pay possibly higher costs for a certified landscaper that has CEU requirements, which I don't believe they're going to have to raise their rates in order to meet that. They're already getting a lot of education in other places, and what we need to do is bring everyone to the table to have these discussions around our irrigation challenges to the distribution system. I realize that there's lots of other education that's going to be out there besides irrigation education, but if everyone has to come to the table, then we will be able to disseminate that information along with other safety issues and other classes. So I just wanted to point out that although there are some minimal costs to the contractor, possibly, and some time required, which often those classes are offered in the winter, that the public will be have a much greater cost and for not having those CEU required contractors coming to the table for irrigation education. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Mr. Griffiths next, and just in the interest of time, I just want to make sure that we do have some written testimony. If you could give us the highlights of what you see in the bill and why it's valuable, that would be great. Mm-hmm. So, welcome, and thanks for coming over from Bend today.
You're welcome. It's a beautiful drive. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Patrick Griffiths, I'm the Water Resources Coordinator for the City of Bend. I also am a member of the Landscape Contractors Board. I'm also representing today the Central Oregon Cities Organization, which is made up of the Central Oregon cities who are very involved in water issues, as well as the Oregon Water Utility Council, which I attend regularly, and that is an organization that represents the large water providers throughout the state of Oregon. But I think I can boil it down for you. Three things that I think are relevant to this bill for us. That is, the water providers are going to support this bill. We want to make this easy, efficient, and cost-effective for any landscaper to attend. We're going to back that up with free or low-cost classes for licensed landscapers. They don't have to be members of any trade association to attend our classes. We're going to provide that across the state, and we've already talked about it at the state level. We're on board. We are mandated as water providers to create a water management and conservation plan to get a new water right. And as part of that, we have budgeted
hundreds of thousands of dollars for education and water conservation related, as well as safe drinking water issues related to providing drinking water through the Cross Connection program and other things. It's relevant for you guys to know that we have, for the city of Bend, it took 14 years to get a 20-year water supply permit. If we had done more education during the course of getting that permit from the Oregon Water Resource Department, we probably wouldn't have taken that long. And so part of the requirement for CEUs, I think, is to form that partnership with the landscape industries. We can't do it alone as water providers. We need everybody on board, and we want to give them the best and latest information to help them do their jobs and make their businesses successful. Lastly, wearing my LCB hat, my landscape contractor's board hat, I want to emphasize that this does not apply to landscape maintenance businesses. This is for licensed landscapers. We don't think in any way this is going to prevent people from getting into the industry. We think that's a tough business to get into already due to the testing and the rigorous professional standards that we've created through the board. We feel this bill will raise the professionalism of the landscape industry. We think this is a way to document that to the public, people that are going to be buying the services of these landscape contractors. We think as partners in the water purveyor and other folks, we want to find partners to do better classes to help defray the costs and to provide the most relevant education, not just about water, but about all the other things listed by Mr. Stone earlier. We're already changing things in Landscape Contractors Board. We've upgraded our newsletter. We've sought all of the email addresses of all of our licensed landscapers so we can provide better, more relevant information on a regular basis, not just through the CEU process. It does not limit the choices of what classes can be taken. You can basically 10 hours is the limit that we have right now, and the sky's the limit. We'd like the opportunity through rulemaking to get more dialogue about what the landscapers need, and the board's going to do that through surveys, through phone calls, through meetings, through discussions to find out what it is the landscapers want. And lastly, we feel this is a real solid business opportunity to get the best information out to the landscapers so their businesses can succeed. We want to work around their schedules. We want to work around the constraints of money and time and make this a win for everybody.
Thank you. Before I ask for any questions, I want Judy to testify.
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Judy Ranton. I'm the Water Conservation Program Supervisor for the Portland Water Bureau. I've worked for the Water Bureau for over 20 years and have been in the conservation business since before 1991. And I've worked with conservation professionals around the country and primarily in the region through the Regional Water Providers Consortium since 1993. And those are water providers made of in Clackamas, Washington, Multnomah counties, including Beaverton and Gresham. So in 1992, the Bull Run water users, a large part of the Portland metro area, had a long-term or a short-term water shortage. And at that time, the Portland Water Bureau was authorized to identify and implement water restrictions, many of which impacted the landscape industry in a negative way. Since then, Portland and the Regional Water Providers Consortium staff have participated in an ongoing dialogue with landscape professionals. We have provided no-cost education to them about the limitations that we have for providing peak season summer water, including finite storage, the limited transmission and distribution infrastructure issues that Jill was talking about, fish passage issues, etc. And we have listened to their concerns regarding their customers' desires for green lawn, the lack of incentives to reduce water use due to the low cost of water, and for some, a lack of knowledge about the ways that they can use water more efficiently in landscapes. And as a result of these efforts, some landscape contractors have made significant changes in their practices. However, there are still many more contractors who aren't as aware of the issues facing municipal water providers but still manage a significant amount of our summer municipal water use. So we believe that all the stakeholders would agree that education about efficient ways to do pretty much anything, including managing water, is preferable to forced curtailment during peak season water use. And we believe House Bill 2538 will make many more landscape professionals aware of these water management methods, which will benefit the communities and water users throughout the state. And for our part, Portland and the Regional Water Providers Consortium have and continue to offer no-cost education for landscape professionals professionals, and we do so actually during their non-peak season. And we also offer this education to our end users, so we're educating the customer at the same time, who can make the investment in ensuring that their landscapes are managed efficiently. And we will make every attempt to continue to reach out to other professionals, landscape and irrigation designers, maintenance professionals also who have influence in water management. So thank you for this opportunity to testify, and happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions for any of our panelists here?
Yes, just real quick. Do you provide trainings anyway for a voluntary basis, and do landscapers take advantage of those?
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, yes, we do.
Thank you.
And they have, for us, we started in 1993, and believe me, there were a lot of them at the table then. And over the course of the years, we've had up to 30 or 40 professionals in the same room with us at the same time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, in Eugene, we have not had a water emergency to bring people to the table. And so, as I said, we did a major mailing and got 8 people in the room. Thank you.
I'll just add for Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, for Central Oregon, we have put on the High Desert Green Industry Conference, green being the landscape industry, for the last 13 years. The attendance has slowly climbed, and we haven't had, in our opinion, the right people coming to the table and to these classes we put on every year on an annual basis. We think this will fill the room and get the word out that we've spent a lot of time and money putting together so that we're getting out a consistent message and that we're not confusing the public with conflicting messages that sometimes come through lesser trained landscapers that are pushing their product and their services that might not meet today's goals of some of the issues we talked about earlier. So we're hoping this will bring in more folks.
Any other questions? Senator George.
I understand the need for the fill. At the same time, I have great heartburn, I guess, with the agency and its rule writing authority with how strict you could write this. Because we have, I mean, the real problem is not with the big guys because they're constantly cutting edge. It's the family that is, you know, somebody passes contractors and he does it on a job-by-job basis. 10 hours a year is a lot of his time compared to some of these big guys. And so I'm concerned about the agency writing rules that make it difficult for people to access those hours. And I guess what I'm looking for is perhaps some agency and some board reassurance that this is going to be as easy as possible, that you can get the 10 hours online if you need to, those kind of things. This pretty much goes against things I believe in, although I do understand the reason for the bill. So,
Chair Metzger, Senator George. I agree with your question, and I understand, I think, the intent of your question. A couple things I can tell you as a board member. I grew up in a small business, a family-run business, and when I checked that post office box every week and the checks didn't come in, I knew how my dad was going to react to that. And so if he was off at a conference or a seminar to try to get continuing educations, you know, there was a certain connection there. And so I think as a board member and the discussions we've already had at the board, we don't necessarily see 10 hours right away. We might start out with a lot less than that annually. We want to get as much feedback as we can from the industry and continue to work with them so that it's working for them. We just don't want to impose something that doesn't work and is punitive. We want it to be the best bill and the best CEU program that we can develop that's efficient, that's low cost, and serves the needs of the industry.
Mr. Vincent, I guess what I'm looking for is how do you reassure us that that's what we're going to end up with? I mean, there's a certain amount of trust, I suppose, that we've got to give when we grant agencies rule writing power. But in this, I'm trying to figure out where the constraints are in this. It seems like to me that the board could make this very easy or make this very difficult within the scope of this particular legislation. And I guess I'm looking for any kind of I mean, I guess we're making a commitment here, but we need a commitment that we're going to actually make sure that this is accessible to people outside of normal business hours and those kind of things. Because I'm going to tell you what, my concern is if this 10 hours comes out of a work day of a guy who's trying to feed his family, and he's the contractor, and he's the only guy, and it happens only during the daytime, and he can't go at nighttime, he can't go, you know, or he can't do it online, that concerns me very, very much, because that's a big chunk of income.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I can give you the best assurance from this day is that you can get as far as the discussions we've already had. The people on the board already are committed landscapers, licensed. I'm a public member. I'm not a licensed landscaper. I have CEU requirements and two other areas of my job that I do annually. Those that can be a burden. I think the discussion's already been to the point where we want to make this easy. We want to make this doable. We want to make this as clear and concise as possible. And I have talked to our administrator of putting a rules advisory committee together to make sure that we get as much information from the industry as possible so that maybe we create categories for folks that have they're a sole proprietor and they don't have to do as many hours. There's lots of different ways we can be flexible with this and make this work for the industry.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, thank you. We just got a brief moment. Mr. Uluberry, you asked to testify. If you can make it very brief, you can come up and make your comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. Thank you for hearing me. I knew I wouldn't be able to make it by 1 o'clock, so my wife...
Give us your name for the record.
My name is Jameson Uluberry. I run Sunlight Landscapes, and I just wanted primarily to address two prongs of one point. You asked a question, Mr. Chair. Is this 10 hours really burdensome? Couple of points. It couldn't be one day. I can go out and work 10 hours easily, but these classes that we're aware of, they're not 10-hour classes. They're 4-hour, 5-hour, 6-hour. You know, even if it's 8-hour, okay, it's going to go into the next day. Second point, is it burdensome? You know, it's not hugely burdensome, but it's part of the process. How much regulation is there now, and how much is yet to come? This is just one step in that process. So it's not that this bill is going to kill numerous landscapers. I mean, it may push a few over the edge, you know, and the next law that comes down will push a few more. It's the incrementalism of it. Part B of that same question, when we consider the effectiveness, I don't think this bill is going to be effective in solving water conservation issues. It'll do a little bit because a few of these people will take water conservation classes. Pesticide, there's already regulation on pesticide use. If we need more, okay, maybe we do. I don't know. But again, these classes, it's a broad approach. If there's a real need in water conservation, pesticide application, or even drainage or whatever, if there's some specific real needs, which there are, then let's address it specifically. Because if this bill will do very little to solve those issues. And so some of the same people with the same concerns, legitimate concerns, are going to be back here in 2 years saying, we need these concerns addressed. So perhaps we just need a better bill, something that's going to address these problems very specifically.
Thank you, Mr. Uluberry. Any questions for Mr. Uluberry? Okay, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2538, and we are adjourned.